So, Sam, just make sure you get back over to Aunt Ruby's website and give them a 1-star review because because you ate so many peanuts that your jaw got tired.
That's what I'm saying. I only eat peanuts a handful at a time, and after 2 handfuls, my jaw got tired. 1-star. Mixed soft peanuts, Aunt Ruby.
Butterscotch.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 263 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm sitting tall.
I'm Sam, and I'm wearing a blue shirt today.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is June 14th, 20 Blundy. Before we get started, we have a warning. Swears. We're going to do them a lot. Be ready. We'd also like to thank our recurring supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. Thank you very much for letting us grab your money. Let's talk about life and the world.
Well, I do want to say, though, before we even get into that, Sam mentioned his shirt being blue as a sort of defining characteristic, and that sounds silly, unless you're looking at his video right now, which I have never seen a more blue picture in my entire, because every wall is blue. Same shirt is blue.
There's also a mirror on one of the
doors. There's a mirror reflecting blue stuff, so it's just a blue void with Sam's head floating in the middle of
it. What was that movie, Crouching Tiger, that like has different sort of color motifs for the different sections of the story?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Really intense about it, yeah.
Also, that weird comedy show with James Acaster, which is fucking stellar.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody should go watch that. That's a 3-parter. Each one has a different color theme for
I wish I could just reason. Like put a filter on this to sort of just shift the color around depending on the mood. Because the thing is like it's called color grading, right? Or color keys if you're doing like 3D movies and stuff. They use it to make sure that you know, like if you whip back and forth between a couple different, you know, segments of the story, that you actually know almost intuitively where it is based on the color schema.
Well, this is the weird thing is because Sam's all blue, there's clearly like sun coming in on half of your face though, right? But but except for that, because of the blue, which, you know, blue filters always use in movies to say it's nighttime now, you know, it has this very upsetting kind of a confusing vibe of it's like exactly daytime and nighttime simultaneously.
This is how I keep you guys winter toasty during the podcast. You know, I'm just like, I need to put you guys on edge so we can pop off about industry stuff.
Maybe I could work on, because I know in The Matrix, anytime they show sort of the inside of the Matrix in the simulation, it's kind of like a sickly, diseased green. Mm-hmm. Like it's a green where you're like, something's wrong, right?
Yep.
I need to figure out how to get that vibe going.
Yeah, I think you still have a green screen back in your basement.
Ooh, yeah. I do. I'm looking at it's 2 feet away from me. I got to get that thing put
up. Hang that up.
Yeah. All right, we need to talk about lacrosse balls.
Okay, listen, everyone. I have done physical therapy for my back to like fix it because it was hurting like hell. I have done, I don't know, I bought some other stuff to like try to fix my back or fix my body from having various pains. Okay, and then bought some of these lacrosse balls. Literally, it's like I think it's just called a lacrosse ball. Like
they're
roller
just
thing.
Hard rubber balls.
It's like a hard rubber ball, right? And they're called lacrosse balls because it's the size of a lacrosse ball. It's not an actual lacrosse ball, though you could use one. Apparently, people also use tennis balls, golf balls, whatever. Point is, I spent $12, okay, after months of doing PT stuff. And also with the realities of the pandemic, you know, I can't go get in no way can I get a massage right now. Like, that's just not happening. So I got to figure out how to handle this myself. And so you get one of these lacrosse balls for like $12, actually two of them for $12. And then you roll around on this thing. So that's the weird part because it is odd because you put the ball on the ground and then you sort of like roll your body around on it, right? Which sounds like it's easy. Weirdly takes a strange amount of coordination and strength to do, which is so I was like with the 1-star complaints that these balls get is someone's like, I didn't realize that you would have to like be doing push-ups the entire time, right? While you're rolling your body around or, you know, whatever else.
Doesn't really seem like the ball's fault. That, you know, that you didn't give it a 1-star. The ball is just being a ball. And if we're all, can all say it's doing a great job at being a ball.
So what these things do, though, is you lay on it and it basically gives you a deep tissue massage, right? But exactly where you want it and exactly how painful you want it. And so it's one of those things, like, I thoroughly enjoy if I'm getting massaged, someone just like beating the hell out of me, right? It's like, I'm into
except for the one time you got literally caned. That was
that. That actually happened. I think we talked about
this. There is a line There is a line you can cross in terms of beating the hell out of somebody during a massage.
Yeah, using a cane. That was, once a cane comes out, that's probably time to
once a weapon enters the scene.
Yeah. It's so in this case, what I'm able to do then is I'll go for a run or something, come back upstairs, get showered up, cool down, not sweat anymore, and then just like throw one of these balls on the ground, put it under my foot, roll it around for like 30 seconds. Foot feels better. Amazing. Okay. Just lay down on it. Now my back, roll around for like 10 more minutes. Just carving up, that place between your shoulder blades and your spine where it's like there's just knots back there. Just rolling that ball in there. Hurts so bad.
I assume the whole time you're rolling around this ball, you're just like, oh yeah.
I'm mainly like, ah. That's usually just screams. A lot of swearing.
Can we loop back on this idea that somebody bought a ball and gave it a 1-star review because they personally don't have the core strength to use the ball properly.
I think it's sort of metaphorical isn't even the right word. It's just literally the same thing that everybody reviews anything. That's how people review games. They're like Seth, I couldn't figure out how to click on this thing, 1-star mm-hmm. review.
Right. But the idea that like this thing does literally 100% of the things that it says that it does perfectly, which is a ball. And that you would give the ball a 1-star review because of something you did.
Well, if you take this back to, say, Quadrupus Rampage, we made exactly one promise with Quadrupus Rampage. We said, Be a quadrupus, go on a rampage. Anything that was below a 5-star review on that game made absolutely no sense because we delivered on the one promise that we made.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
That's our fault.
Right. I'm trying to imagine there's scenarios like somebody buys a 45-pound plate, for a barbell. And then they go to 1-star review and they're like, it's too heavy.
Or not heavy enough. I bet you absolutely anything that if you were to go look at Amazon reviews for barbells, there will be complaints about the exact heaviness of that barbell.
This barbell's too long. Yeah. It's the length of a barbell. That's how long they are. What are you doing?
Seth had mentioned this because we started watching Parks and Rec. And Seth had mentioned that the scenes where Leslie Knope is in front of like a group of civilians who are talking about
their town halls.
Are absolutely hilarious, and if you're a person who makes products, especially, you'll be especially tickled by them because they sound exactly like the complaints that we get on occasion for all of our games. So one of them, I think, was the person who was like, "I found a sandwich in the park, and there was no mayonnaise on it."
Yeah, and they were like, "Who eats a sandwich in the park without mayonnaise?" Yeah. And they're screaming at them.
Like, what?
And then like a random person always tries to start a chant about something.
Yep.
And the best scene, if you haven't watched Parks and Rec, highly recommend. The best is there's a scene in one of the earlier seasons where there's a delegation from Venezuela, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah.
Coming in.
That whole episode is gold.
And Fred Armisen is playing like the ambassador. And he's so confused because he's like, where are the armed men who take these people to jail? Yes, right. He's got this whole spiel about it. But anyways, lacrosse balls.
Yeah. Big
into they are lacrosse balls, 100%, 5 out of 5 stars.
Yeah, honestly. And if you've had some back pain or whatever else, or I know because everyone's switching to work from home setups, if you haven't quite gotten, your good ergonomics going on, get one of these things, just roll around on it for like 10 minutes.
Yeah, my wife has a thing. So she does that also and has been doing that for a while and said it's very good. But she also has these big foam rollers. So they're like, I don't know, 8 inches in diameter, probably something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're really long. And apparently, and you just kind of like, you just lay parts of yourself on them and then use your body weight for the pressure part. And then you just kind of roll back.
Same idea.
So she's been doing this on her legs in particular. Cause apparently like that somehow it's like flattening your muscles, it's like running your muscles through a roller. Mm-hmm. I tried this and it was the most painful thing I've ever experienced in my whole life.
Because it turns out you're probably just made of knots at this point,
Well, no, but it wasn't that kind of pain. It was just like, it made all my joints feel like they had too much like weight on them or something. The whole thing was just horrible. And I couldn't figure out. I was like, this is just something I got to get used to. Or am I? Do I have too much old man stuff going on where I can't actually participate in this kind of an adventure?
So it kind of threw you into like a deeply unsettling emotional pain.
Well, this is the thing. Existential. Yeah, because when you're doing this kind of stuff, there's usually a pain level that's involved and appropriate, right? But if you've never done that thing before, then you don't know what the –
That's very true.
Yeah. You don't know where it is. And so it's one of the things you have to be careful about. So, you know, we're not doctors. If you're going to roll on some lacrosse balls, talk to your doctor.
Due to your point of being comfortable. But I think, yeah, I mean, this happened with my foot, my left foot. And this is one of the weird things you find is you find out all the places where your body, like, because I was like, this hurts like fuck. Like right underneath my, like in sort of in the middle right side of my left foot. And I was like, I wonder if this just hurts. If this is just like a place that hurts, right? You know, to mm-hmm. put some pressure on. And so I did it on my right foot, felt fine. And I was like, oh shit, that means that like
something's wrong.
There's something going on over there. So I rolled it more and then it felt better after a couple of days of doing that. So
yeah, you're probably discovering all kinds of weaknesses.
Honestly, yeah.
Didn't know you had.
Turns out my left hip's like super weird. I don't know. I mean, I've actually known that for a long time. But there's it's just all that stuff.
My left hip is also weird.
What is with us in our hips? It's
possible that there's some kind of genetic link. I couldn't explain it, but there might be.
Seth, how's your left hip doing?
My hips are great. Shapely. They cannot lie.
Supple.
It's because of all the squats.
Just
100% fantastic. We also need to talk about this chocolate and peanut butter technique.
Okay, yeah.
I don't know what this means.
So here's the thing. When I would go to the grocery store, because this is a thing that, you know, was a thing you used to do before the pandemic, I would always buy usually like a Reese's cup, you know?
Oh, yeah. I miss aisle candy.
Oh, yeah. The sort of personal snack tax.
Checkout candy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so that was a thing I got to look forward to every week. And I hadn't really thought about it too much because, of course, it was hard to even notice that this love of mine had disappeared, frankly.
There's a piece of your soul that was missing, but you just didn't notice.
So, a Reese's piece.
A Reese's piece.
It's sort of like a cascade of discoveries this past 2 weeks. First, I was eating a banana, and Diana was like, you should put some peanut butter on that. And I was like, but then I'd have to dip this entire banana into the peanut butter jar. I don't know why that's how I thought this would happen.
That would be insane.
Simply no other way.
Diana just squinted at me and she was like, just use a fork. It puts some peanut butter on the fork and then put it on the banana. And I was like, whoa. And so did it. I did it. And I was like, this is fucking delicious. Okay, fast forward to a couple days ago. We get a fresh load of chocolate bars in from our, you know, delivery, some Instacart, whatever, groceries show up at the house. I'm eating a piece of chocolate. What kind of chocolate bars?
This is important. I just have to know.
So this is the Lindt sea salt chocolate. That's it. And the reason I like that one is because I think it tastes absolutely ridiculously delicious. Okay. That's the only one reason for that. So
yeah, I mean, it's chocolate. What else? You don't need to explain any further.
The Diana always makes fun of me because I'm constantly doing weird things in terms of experimenting. I'll find something that works really well and then I'll try a bunch of other ways to do it that usually are worse before I go back to the original, right?
That's the only way you find out. How else would you know?
Exactly. Sometimes it works out. So I was eating a piece of chocolate, and then I was holding the second piece that I had decided to eat. And I suddenly thought about that banana, and I was like,
I'm going to scoop banana goo with this.
No, not quite. I was like, I could just rub peanut butter onto this piece of chocolate.
Or use a piece of chocolate to scoop peanut butter.
I like how at the beginning of this banana thing – the concept of rubbing peanut butter on something was just like
– you can only dip things in peanut butter. That's the only thing.
And now that you've been discovering
fire.
Your mind is open to the possibilities of rubbing peanut butter on things.
So I started rubbing peanut butter on these chocolate pieces before I eat them. Holy shit.
Yep.
I'm going to be honest. I don't know if I've tasted a greater thing in my life. Then
that's a pretty good strategy. Did you guys?
You've invented a Reese's cup.
A Reese's cup. So last weekend, after the podcast, I was telling Sam and Seth, I was like, you guys, you need to treat yourselves and buy some Aunt Ruby's peanuts.
I know you guys both
ordered them, but I haven't heard anything since. So now I need to know.
How are
those Aunt Ruby's peanuts?
The one word of warning that I did not get from you. So this is my one star.
Did you cut yourself on the thing?
No.
Okay.
Though it is struck. But was actually that the peanuts are so so powerful that it hurts your jaw after a short amount of time if you're shoving them into your mouth with high velocity, which of course is
because you're used to those shitty like those peanuts that just disintegrate.
They just in your mouth. These ones like you have to
chew them.
Yeah, you got to chomp those bad.
You got to crunch to them.
Because the next step though is to take those peanuts with some chocolate and then you just crunch it all at the same time.
Oh my god,
that is way better than even the peanut butter because there's something about like. You're creating the peanut butter by eating it, right?
I'm going to do this after this podcast. I'm going to go down. Oh, my God. I'm going to have a time.
So, Sam, just make sure you get back over to Aunt Ruby's website and give them a 1-star review because you ate so many peanuts that your jaw got tired.
That's what I'm going to say. I only eat peanuts a handful at a time, and after 2 handfuls, my jaw got tired. 1-star. Mixed off the peanuts, Aunt Ruby.
There's simply no other way.
This isn't a meat problem. This is a product problem.
This is the problem with these peanuts is that I ate them 2 handfuls right back to back and my jaw got tired. Mm-hmm. One star.
Ridiculous.
Okay. I feel like this needs to be a recurring segment on the podcast where we give products 1-star reviews because of our own personal failings. I feel like.
Let's do it. I'm in.
All right, let's talk about studio news. The big news of this past week is that Levelhead patch 1.18 went into beta. Why patch 1.18 and not 1.1? Because numbers aren't real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, numbers are real, but their meaning is whatever you want it to be.
Yep. Their meaning is like life. You know, you get to decide your path.
Yeah, and it's an encoding problem, right? It's just you're just mapping a number onto a concept, and like what is one? You know, it could be whatever you want it to be. And if you have 1.1, those are just 2 ones. Which one is which? That? What are they even doing? Yeah,
We probably will name this patch once we actually get to the point of, you know, doing the marketing bit with it.
Currently, it's just B.
So at the moment, we're calling it the Void because, of course, it features a large number of creatures that have emerged from the Void. It has a new power up where Giratin can use Void magic to summon runes and teleport, which is
very spooky.
People have been playing around with it and having a great time. My favorite thing of this patch, I don't remember if we talked about it in the podcast, is the input switch. Did we talk about this?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure
we did.
Yeah.
So people have been playing
around. Refresher.
Yeah. So it's a switch that reads the buttons you press. So it doesn't read anything about like what's happening in the level. It actually reads your button presses. So if you push the A button on the controller, you can make that switch respond to that. And you can even have the switch only activate under certain conditions. So if you want to do that thing that a lot of old school games do where like you walk in front of a door and press up to go into it, you can now recreate that mechanic using portals and eye switches and stuff. So people have already started making DDR games, which I knew immediately. I was like, this is going to happen. But this basically opens up the level editor into being like a mini game editor, and it allows people to make aspects of the level that change depending on what buttons you press or combinations of buttons. Pretty much guaranteed somebody's going to make a pseudo Konami code thing, or even like developers will probably add a dev exits that they can unlock by using some key combination. So lots and lots of cool stuff are going to come out of this. I'm very excited. All the new enemies and
powers. It isn't beta. So that dropped to the beta channel on Friday. On Steam only, but I think this week it's going to open up to Android and iOS maybe.
I think so. Yep.
Probably. So by the time you listen to this podcast, if you want to go jump in and participate in being in the Void, you can go do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it is going to be in beta for quite some time. Just because our time is fairly well split right now between a bunch of different things. And so just know that that's happening.
And also still have to get through CERT.
Console CERT.
Yeah. And CERT is still, at least the last we knew, very delayed due to COVID problems. So so it's going to take a while.
So speaking of splitting time, I want to talk about this interesting, phase of the studio that we are now entering into, which is this kind of a between projects state. So This I like to use the analogy of, if you've played Sonic the Hedgehog, you know that you can run, right? You can just run left, right, and you have some acceleration and you have a certain top speed. But Sonic can also do a thing where he tucks into a ball and doesn't move for some time, but charges up with an incredible amount of energy and then blasts forward like a bullet, mm-hmm. and that you will go a lot faster in the long run if you stop in the short run. And I think this is a great analogy for kind of where we're at, which is before we just like jump right into building the next game, we have a lot of work to do. We gotta step and we gotta spin up our hedgehog ball. So what that amounts to is taking a look at all the things that sort of slowed down progress in Levelhead and fixing all those things. One of those big things is Bscotch ID, which is in all of our older games. It was the first web tech that Adam developed, and it basically makes it so that it's very hard for us to maintain those older games. And that just kind of creates like a constant low level of tech support for us and other problems. And so
– and means you can't take advantage of things. So, you know, on the off chance that somebody came to us and said, hey, I want to put Quadrupus Rampage on the next Ouya, the Ouya of our new generation.
The Ouya 2, the sequel to the famous Ouya.
Then, you know, as enticing as that deal would be, we couldn't participate, which is, you know, a bummer.
Yeah, so those games are basically trapped on the platforms that they were born in. They can't be modified.
People may not even know that actually there is a version of Quadrupus Rampage for PC. Do you guys remember this? This is before my time, but Sam and Seth sold it through like box.com or some weird service.
Yep.
It was available through some weird like executable
downloading
service.
I forgot we even sold it. I thought it was just like a Dropbox.
Yep.
Yeah. There was a thing called Cellbox, which you could
– Cellbox, that's what it was.
You could sell temporary links to Dropbox files, which was super cool. Because like there was no itch. There was no readily available digital storefront that you could just like, put a game onto.
Yeah, because you couldn't put things on Steam at this point. Steam didn't even have a green light yet.
Yeah. And so we were like, well, we want to sell the PC version of this game, but nobody will let us. So we'll do it this way. And also things like Stripe or Square, those didn't exist either.
Yeah. So it was really hard to set up a storefront.
Yeah. So if you wanted to sell something, you had to like solve the tax problems of selling in every country, you know,
it was a different world. Yeah.
Yeah. So our plan right now is to basically say we recognize that even though these older games, I mean, let's be real, they don't make money.
No.
They just don't. They make enough money that between the six of us, maybe one of us can get a stick of gum a week or something like that. But we also recognize
maybe even a sandwich a week, actually.
Yeah, like that's true. It's not nothing. But we recognize that, you know, these games are an important part of the history of the studio and also an important part of the portfolio. We still have players who love playing those games and we want to keep them alive. And that just means doing the work to bring them up to speed and get Bscotch ID out and put Rumpus in. And so we're doing all kinds of fun stuff with that. I mean, it'll even be the case that you'll be able to – or at least here's what we're currently working on – is the ability to log into Rumpus using Bscotch ID.
That's actually already available on the website.
Yeah. It's such an interesting challenge because, of course, Bscotch ID has all this data. It has all these features and stuff, and we have to figure out how do we preserve everything that matters and bring it into Rumpus in a way that doesn't –
Yeah, because we need to bring all the data into Rumpus, but also we need to bring in the functionality. And the data in Rumpus is different. It's a different kind of a database, different kind of storage. Everything is different. And so we have to find a way to – go from – and then we have to basically be able to support legacy clients while we're updating new clients.
Right. Because some people may not have updated to the new one, so we can't just like pull the plug on the thing. So there's lots of interesting challenges. And then on top of that, we have to figure out for the next game, make sure that all of our tech that we've developed for Levelhead, that we get to keep using it because we solved a lot of problems in Levelhead.
Yeah, it's one of the major benefits of if you succeed long enough as a studio is you actually start building up your own sort of studio toolkit that lets you go faster making the things you tend to make, right? Mm-hmm. Which if you don't get to take advantage of that after game number six, then like that's a that's a huge punch in the productivity gut, you know?
I mean,
you
can't. Yep. Yeah. So we don't want to reinvent every wheel. We want to be able to, for example, keep our Xbox sign-in stuff.
Yeah, a lot of this stuff where you're just like, God, I want to ever do that ever again. Not the fun.
Yeah, yeah, especially because we had to, you know, it's not just the technical problems either. It's that we had to make sure that all this stuff conforms to cert requirements on each different platform. Yep. And so being able to already not have to resolve any of those problems again and just have them have the code that already solves the just platform requirements is because it's one of those things too. Like, yeah, you can always go rebuild some stuff from scratch because sometimes that is a more efficient move, right? But what you will forget on your way to doing that was that it's not just the tech that you're replacing, right? There are reasons that all the stuff is the way that it is. And if you ever forget why a certain thing is the way that it is, and you're like, oh, this is dumb, let me just fix this, right? You may now have just given yourself another week of work in the future because it was it was actually had to be that way for some external purpose.
Well, and even worse is here's an interesting hypothetical. Let's say we do go ahead, and as we work on the next game, which we believe is Crashlands 2, as we go to work on this, let's say, you know, 2 years in, it's like, okay, it's time. It's time to solve these cert problems for the Switch or something like that. We start working on solving those problems, and we do. But then we find out there's some new requirements, so we fix those things. But then we go back and look at Levelhead, and we're like, oh my God, Levelhead doesn't meet these requirements, right? So then what do we do? Do we redo all that work again? No, right? So what we have to do is update all of our systems so that everything is centralized, and if we like solve a particular login problem or cert problem, that we're able to push that solution out into all of the games of our portfolio.
And we've been actually ran into this with Crashlands because we were working on a bug fix patch, I think, for Switch, and then we tried to skid it through cert, and we couldn't because there's a new requirement got added or a new test got added that we previously didn't have to meet, and so we didn't even know it was a problem. And then suddenly we did, and now we're like, shit. And it had to do with actually a set of problems that we have already solved for Levelhead.
Yep.
That we couldn't bring back into Crashlands because things were not modular enough to allow for that.
Yeah. And so it's an interesting problem that I think if you're early in your game dev career as a smaller studio, it's something that you're not really going to think about is the cost of maintenance. It's the cost of having a portfolio of games that you want to keep alive, but while wanting to be able to move forward with your new game projects. Because there's a term in software engineering called software rot, which I think is a pretty good term. But it's basically the idea that a piece of software gets developed in an ecosystem that has like a certain set of context. Like maybe it was made for Windows XP or, you know, whatever it is. And over time, the context changes and eventually the software reaches a point where it just no longer is dead. It just no longer functions at all.
Or to get it to function, the requirements are varied. So if you think of like COBOL mainframes, right, which still run a really enormous amount of our infrastructure, but the number of people who actually know how to manage those and maintain that data is so tiny that you can basically like – you can write your own check in terms of getting paid because it's so hard to migrate that data and to deal with it that because there's the everything is just so different now than what it was, you know, in the COBOL days. So this is actually one of the reasons that during the COVID stuff that everybody – all the different United States states unemployment offices basically were unable to handle it was because they were based on these old COBOL databases that hadn't been updated in literally 30 years, right? And that they couldn't just add hardware to because it was too complicated and nobody knew how to do it. And they couldn't just hire more people because the job market for that is so tiny, right? That there was basically no way for them to quickly expand. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this is kind of so that even if things are actually, but if you think about that stuff's been working for 30 years or whatever, right? With like
under a very specific fragile set
very specific
of unchanging circumstances.
Yeah, exactly. And as soon as you get outside that circumstance, if you haven't been able to update things as you go to take advantage of newer technologies and, you know, and newer concepts, and to take advantage of, in the case of something like COBOL, a broader talent market of people who know how to program something, right? Because often, even if a language is better than another language for its specific purpose, it might still be better to move it to the you know, to the worst language that has more people who can program it, right? So yeah, you just get stuck in these, and it's kind of funny idea that you can have a piece of software that is unchanged, and even when its actual like physical context in terms of the machines it's on don't change, right? At some point, something is going to happen. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really matter that it worked perfectly fine then, because if it takes 10 years to break and you're like, oh shit, hard drives don't even exist anymore. I can only find SSDs, right?
Yep.
Except for these old hard drives that have stopped. Nobody's making them anymore. So they're all like 3 years old and I have to buy them for like $500 a pop on eBay or whatever, right? Like that's the kind of shit you run into if you don't keep moving your stuff along with how the tech and the job.
Yeah, but it's such a red flag like to me when I hear about a company that oh yeah, all everything that we do runs on we only use Windows XP on our computers.
Right? Oh yeah, yeah. That means they're under such a mountain of tech debt, and they have no good.
Yeah, and the fact is, like, how long do you think this is going to be able to keep going for? You know, mm-hmm. you've built your castle on quicksand.
Yep.
And it's sinking slowly, and you're like, well, I mean, we can still see out the windows. Like, yes, they are at ground level now. Yeah. But like
keeps getting higher, right? And this is basically the experience that we had with Bscotch ID, which was when I first started making Rumpus. The idea at that time was, well, let's make Rumpus first, right? Because we're using a level head anyway. We'll sort of design it in the context of level head. We'll make it first, kind of figure out how this is going to work, and then figure out how to bring stuff over. And what ended up happening is the longer we let Rumpus develop without trying to bring in Bscotch ID. The sort of the more just divergent these things were becoming, mm-hmm. but also the more things were slowly going wrong with Bscotch ID, right? And yep. and then not being addressed because like we'll just deal with that later. And so
I mean, we got people sending in bug reports when they're like, when I log into Bscotch ID on Android on these games, it just crashes. And
yeah,
this has been the case for months, and we're like, we know, but
there's nothing we can do, right?
That's just what it is. Yep.
Yep.
So that's the phase that we're in as a studio is basically we're saying before we move to the next thing, we need to get our fucking castle out of the quicksand.
Get a foundation under there.
We need to strengthen the foundations of things and develop systems to make sure that – and also go back and like one of our core studio principles is, you know, always know why, right? And looking at this situation that we're in and ask ourselves, how did this happen? What structures do we have in place that allowed this to happen or even encouraged it to happen? Mm-hmm. And how do we change those structures to keep this from happening going forward? So it's a very interesting time, and I think kind of depending on your personality, this can maybe rub you the wrong way in certain cases because it doesn't feel like you are, quote, producing. Because at the end of the day, you will look at the stuff that you have and it will be the same stuff that you started with.
Yeah, your best case scenario is ended up right back where you were, which is things work, right?
But things work. Yeah. But now they are malleable. They're changeable. They're flexible. They're modular. You can move forward much faster. It's the Sonic Hedgehog spin, right? You didn't move for a while. But now you get to go super fast. And this, I think, is wrapped up neatly in that quote, don't mistake activity for progress. Just because you're producing stuff doesn't mean you're actually moving forward in a meaningful way. So anyways, that's kind of where we're at as a studio. It's kind of this transformative shoring up our issues stage. So let's talk about some industry news. Now, last week, of course, we talked a lot about the protests and the Black Lives Matter movement, and itch.io put together this bundle for racial justice, which is where developers could put their games into this itch.io bundle, and all the proceeds go to causes for promoting racial equity and justice. And they have raised at the time of this recording, about $6.5 million.
Yeah. It is wild.
It is.
1,700 games in there.
Mm-hmm.
So like if you want just to have the games, just all of the games, if you're like, I'm interested in playing
games,
just, you know, video games as like a universal concept.
Mm-hmm. And it's all indie stuff on itch, right? So it's like any possible game concept you can imagine is represented in there.
Yeah. There's a lot of like weekend hobby games where, you know, some person was just, they just jammed out something and they're like, you know what? I want to support this cause. And they dunked their game into there. You've got some famous indies, like, you know, you've got things like Overland in there and
Night in the Woods, some Vlambeer stuff.
Night in the Woods, Vlambeer. Like there's just some really, really high quality stuff in there. And it's like $5.
Yeah. Like
$5. I mean, I cannot imagine.
Yeah, the schedule though is like this will be unavailable by the time the podcast goes live, unless they extend the date on it. And given how well it's doing, that would be that surprising.
Yeah. Yeah. So hopefully they extend it. But in any case, I mean,
I think the main thing is just how impressive it is that they because I think that to me the takeaway was just how unexpectedly that blew up because there's this kind of idea out there that it's really hard to sell indie games, right? And that nobody wants them. And they're a whole bunch of garbage, blah, 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 right? And there's also ideas out there about how hard it is to get people to give money for causes and stuff, right? And a lot of what like Humble Bundle, these things try to do is they try to kind of marry these concepts together where they say, hey, like these games might not otherwise like be into. And like maybe these charities you wouldn't just normally just directly give money to. If we hook those two things together, we might create this like this actual powerful incentive so that now a whole bunch of people went out, right? And I think this thing exemplifies the power of that in this really cool way. Because if you look at the games in there, like there are some from some pretty well known devs and some pretty well known titles. But for the most part, it's just like eclectic indie stuff that are being made by people, you know, solo devs in their basements and, you know, like as I said, over weekends or whatever, right? So it's almost like an art collective kind of a deal. Pairing that with a thing that people really care about, because I'm trying to think of another thing that I've heard about for this same cause in particular that has collectively raised $6.5 million, right? Like,
nope.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not about individual celebrities like dropping $1 million or something like that, but
yeah. No. And if they had just made that bundle and just said, hey, this is a bundle, you can just buy it for $5, and that was it. I can't see it generating $6.5 million of revenue, right?
No.
But by marrying these two things together, you actually get I think it's just kind of a very cool demonstration of the power of this stuff and the power of games and also the power of indie games, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's really cool. And if it's still available, you should definitely go get it. And if not, you should still go see what was in there and then maybe just go scope some of it out and support some developers. And of course, also support Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. And just you can do that separately. But every once in a while, I'm reminded about just how much
people care.
Stuff there is out there, you know, like because I think about it like with movies, you know, with movies, like you always think of the big, you know, the blockbuster stuff. That's what you advertise. That's what you go see. And there's that collection of people who go watch indie movies, right? And it feels like there aren't very many, but certainly there must be a fuckload, right? And games is actually the same space. You know, there's a fuckload of stuff out there, people doing really weird, interesting things. And just getting to see that highlighted again in this really big way was very neat.
And frankly, I mean, the only other time that you can get nearly 2,000 of something for $5 is when you buy a bag of rice. But
yeah, that's also like, true.
That is such a ridiculous number. Of things to get for $5.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So that's a very cool thing. And it does make me, proud to be part of this industry. And seeing that forward thinking and awareness and willingness for people, both the developers to, put their games in there, of a platform like Itch to put this together. And of course, of all the people who said, yeah, like I want to support this.
Yeah. That's a lot of people showing up. A lot of people. Right.
Yep.
Yes.
It's crazy. Yeah.
Kudos all around. We'd also like to, before we go into questions, talk a little bit about The Last of Us 2, just in the fact that apparently it's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's so rare that you see something, and it's not even out yet. It comes out, I think, end of this week. But all the previews are in from all of the press, and it's just straight 10s out of 10s, 5s out of 5s. And this is such a rare, I think God of War is the last one I remember kind of hitting that. Mm-hmm.
God of War, I think Breath of the Wild was before that.
And Breath of the Wild, yeah. These are so rare that you hit that level of consensus opinion where everyone is just, you know, blown away.
People are just like, there's nothing wrong with this.
Yeah.
So it did everything. I did not, my jaw didn't get tired while I was chewing the peanuts, you know, like just 10
Of course, 10 once around. It hits players, it's going to be a different story because the players are going to be the ones, you know, complaining about how much they have to chew those peanuts.
That's true.
So mostly I'm just very impressed. I think that's Naughty Dog? Is that who makes Last of Us. So huge congrats to Naughty Dog for what I'm sure was very painful development and release process. Yep. And they've been under fire for a lot of stuff because all of the sexists have come out of the woodwork about this game in particular and have been harassing their employees. So huge congrats to them for making it through all of that and then putting together just a fucking apparently spectacular game. So good, in fact, that I'm gonna have to buy a PlayStation, but I'm going to wait until this next generation so that I can come back and play games like this.
Yeah, because, you know, no offense to PS4, but nobody wants a hard drive.
No.
So slow.
Ugh.
No, we'll wait for the solid state drive generation to hit the shelf.
And it's just around the corner.
Who has 4 seconds, you know, to wait for a loading screen? Nobody. I'm not made of time. All right, let's get on to questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. The highest upvoted question comes from Chalosis, who says, what are some pie-in-the-sky feature ideas from early on in Levelhead's development that never made it in?
the biggest one is the story, like the overworld.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It's going to be a Pokemon-style overworld.
Yeah, people from the Shenanicon, I think, actually saw, right? To be sure,
that's true. Yeah.
So,
or was it 2 Shenanicons ago?
Yeah, it was when we were like 6 months in. So we'd actually prototyped it, and what it was you actually had a character. So your employee body was there, and you would actually wander around the world, like
that main menu was not going to, like the main menu picture that you see in Levelhead of the campus wasn't going to be there. It was going to be a physical place.
And you'd have to like walk over to the Rumpus building to log in and stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the tower had floors and you would take the elevator like up and down the tower.
Which is actually why it's a tower because the main menu sort of is the distillation of all the ideas that we had for the overworld.
But the best thing was that you would battle other employees by your GR18s just following you around. And then you'd go talk to someone and then they would like, you know, say some shit and you'd throw down. And so you'd have to play through all of their levels that they had themselves. So they could have, it's just like Pokemon, up to like 5 or 6 levels, like 10 to 15 minutes of content basically. And then you would have to defeat all of their levels with a certain amount of lives or something. I can't remember exactly how we did it, but it was something where it was equivalent to HP.
It was going to be that your GR18 had a battery, and every time it respawned, it used a little bit of its battery, and so you would basically have to like go out and try to defeat. Basically, you were going out trying to work your way up the corporate ladder by impressing other employees, right, and get promotions by showing how good you were at training your GR18. Yep. But of course, if your battery died, then your GR18 didn't work anymore and you had to go recharge it before you could go try again.
Yeah, so things like, I love the concept. The problem is, when you think about how much content, think about how many battles exist in something like Pokemon. There's a shit ton of them, right? If you think each person has anywhere from 1 to 6 Pokemon available that you can burn through, probably averaging around 3, I would imagine. And there's literally hundreds of these people in any given Pokemon game. And what we quickly realized while we were working on it is, one is, of course, you know, we love building worlds, but it didn't seem like it would be necessary to get the overall point of Levelhead across, which is building levels. So, again, one of those, maybe this is an extra feature, even though it's cool sort of things. But the biggest one was the realization that unless we were going to build these levels procedurally, there was no way to build enough content in this for this sort of context to have it not feel weird. Because if you think about the whole campaign is like 93 levels or 94 levels, something like that. Mm-hmm. If you just divide those up over like just 3 at a time over people, that's just like 30 people. Like if you want a place to feel like that doesn't feel like
it's not enough.
It's just not enough. And so we were like this, it would literally have to be like 10x that.
Yeah. The ideas just didn't have like having levels that you play in the battle context just didn't quite work.
It was one of those, it would be cool if, but it wouldn't be cohesive or sensible or cost effective.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. But importantly, we did prototype it we didn't walk all the way down. Yeah. We didn't walk all the way down that to that point of being like, would this be realistic in terms of content development? We actually just prototyped it within like a day or two of thinking about it. And it was
It was pretty
fucking awesome.
It was very fun.
Yeah, and we had like the characters whose levels you played.
They would talk in between each level.
Yeah, so like
you would
start playing the level, the title of the level would come in, and then the character's face would pop in, and they'd be like, "Let's see if you can get past my spike trap."
They'd be like, "There's no way you'll get past this one," and then you get thrown into the next level, right?
And so we had like one character just made just really terrible, boring levels, but was like super pumped about them and thought that you definitely would be able to beat these like dead simple levels. And so it gave us a huge range of opportunities to tell story and tell jokes and have like fun characters and stuff. And so that was the part
wheelhouse.
And that was a part that I think that it's kind of a bummer there wasn't a way to marry those that was feasible, you know?
Honestly, there is. It just would have needed another year.
That's what I mean by the feasible part, right? It was just too costly to do it.
There's no necessarily – there's not necessarily a good reason to think that that would make the game more appealing.
No.
I think to me it's a unique differentiator. You know, it's a unique selling point. It builds the world in it. And I still believe that if we had – done that, if we had been able to do that, it would have been pretty incredible. Is there like that, you know?
Put its own angle on it. That is certainly true.
Yeah, but even just I feel like one of our strengths as a studio is just like all of the characters and goofy jokes, you know, and having all of these people who are out wandering around in the Bureau of Shipping whose levels you get to play is just so cool. But I do think that one of the things we learned over the course of Level Heads development was that we were putting so much emphasis on the campaign that we really shouldn't have, you know, because we only needed the campaign to be enough to have like a good set of cohesive levels that provide challenges and teach the game. But we don't want to have an infinitely deep set of features in the campaign because that's not the point. That's what the online levels are for, right? Yeah. And the more engaging the campaign is, the less reason people have to go play other people's levels, and then that kind of kills the ecosystem. So there's a balance to strike there. And so – but anyways, I mean that was I think probably the biggest pie in the sky feature. Yep. We also had a bunch of game modes. So we had a golf mode.
Oh, yeah.
With a round package that was a ball.
We had flop rocket mode, which was – that was the one that I was very excited about, and I'm still kind of bummed we don't have because I still love just how flop rocket plays just as a control scheme in terms of how you interact with a player character. And being able to craft levels for that, especially because we allow you to go vertical also. So given all the really fun, weird stuff that we have for setting up levels – being able to interact with the level in that way specifically, I thought would have been really spectacular. And we have prototypes of it, so like we got to play it. It was very fun.
It exists. Mm-hmm. It's fun,
it causes a tremendous number of problems. It's the short way to say.
Yeah, yeah, and so does the golf. Like the golf worked about 60% because one of the fundamental things you'll see in like a mini golf game or a golf game, whatever, is, you know, you hit the ball, and when the ball stops moving, that's where it lies, right? And then that's where your next hit starts. What about a game like Levelhead, where you've got treadmills and bumpers and bouncers and basically things that could trap the ball in an infinite loop of movement? Now you need like expiration timers. It's like, oh, the ball's been trapped for 5 seconds, so now we're gonna
reset it whenever they want and just add a stroke to their thing, but then they get penalized for goofy physics that we programmed.
There's all kinds of stuff, but we had it fully implemented, so it was like a turn-based thing. And then the creators, it would keep track of your strokes and then time. So there was like a speed running element to it. And then par became the number of strokes that it took the creator to beat the level in. But it is the case though that like some of the most fun stuff of the core game, like the power-ups and the combat, like that doesn't exist in golf mode, you know. It's just a whole other thing. And we just kind of found that making one really, really good game is hard, and then doing it four times is hard. It takes four times the resources. So we just decided to streamline and work on the stuff that we thought would sort of galvanize the player base the most, which is the core game. All right, next question comes from Gear Whip Toppy Beep. Would you ever, under any circumstance accept a buyout or merger with a larger game studio. I ask because I'm surprised at how willing many indie devs are to join a huge company and completely change their workflow.
The comment there was under any circumstance. So the answer there is a square yes. There would be circumstances under which we would do it. One of them is if we were just tired, you know, and wanted out.
Yeah. You've been doing this for 30 years and you say, hey, you know, we want our IP to keep living on.
Yep.
But like our bones are hurting now.
Yep. Our eyes hurt too much. We can't program anymore. Can't do art, you know, whatever.
It's time. And at a certain point, you know, it's like we need to hand this off to a capable
young person.
more resources.
More cartilage, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, right now that is we have had these kinds of conversations with larger studios or larger companies who come to us and say like, hey, we like what you guys are doing and where you're going. Do you want to talk about investments? Do you want to talk about a buyout? Do you want to talk about ownership, right? Basically buying equity. Mm-hmm. The thing about equity though is – People always think about the upfront, right? Like somebody comes in and they're like, I want to give you X dollars and I want to be a 10% owner of your company or whatever. That person doesn't want to never see their money again.
Yeah.
They want to get it back out.
10 times that much money back as soon as possible.
They want to get it out. They want it to grow and then they want to take it out.
Which means at some point you're going to have to give that person that money back. But actually not just that money, a whole bunch more than that.
Yeah, and on top of that,
it's just a loan.
Equity is a fake loan. It's a zero interest loan. Well, that's actually a much higher interest loan, really, but with an indeterminate buyout date, right? Mm-hmm. But there's also, you know, once somebody's a part owner, then there's questions about input and
who gets to decide things.
Who gets to decide things and the stance we've kind of taken on this is, and we've also seen it tons of times. We've seen – I'm not going to name specific companies, but like we've personally have talked with plenty of indie developers who were part of smaller studios, ended up getting bought by large companies who were working on expanding their IPs. And oftentimes these smaller studios would get tasked with like, okay, you're going to make the next game for our major IP. But it turns out that there were actually like 9 studios all making games for that IP. And the goal of the large company was to say, it's cheap for us to pay these indie devs because they work for peanuts. And so we're going to hire a whole bunch of teams. And whichever team is making the best progress after a year, that's the one we'll go with. And we'll just shut down the rest of the studios.
Yep.
We've seen this happen dozens of times.
Yeah, because it could be cheaper for a large company just to buy a small company than to actually do the work themselves or to even – hire the company to do the work, right?
Yeah. And so what you have to understand is if you get bought out, you are not a company anymore. You're an investment. Mm-hmm. That's what your studio is. Your studio is now somebody else's investment and they're looking for a payout. And if at any point it looks like that payout isn't going to come, they will shut it down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, it's over. Like they'll sell the assets and they're like, well, this didn't work. It's over now. We're going to sell everything off and try to get some of our money back, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But as far as the why, because the whole point of like this person has seen a bunch of indie devs who have done this, I think people don't – it's very easy to think that running your own thing is just going to be awesome. But the reality is this is stressful as fuck. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, and I think it's been weird because like I've quite a few friends who you know, they do like really cool work stuff, right? They might be engineers or like work on these big projects, but all of them are in big companies, every single one of them, and it's become clearer and clearer over the years that when we talk about things like what you do on the weekends, what you do on your evenings, whatever else, they're operating in just a fundamentally different space. Where yes, they have to be very concerned about like basically, you know, corporate politics, which is annoying as all hell for them.
That's its own thing. Yeah,
it's its own. Yeah, that's the other hell on the other side. But but the reality is like they're not constantly concerned about the company's direction and
the company staying afloat or
whatever. All this other stuff.
So you're sort of in a big company, you're a ship on the ocean, right? And you just whatever happens, like you got to go. So if that, because also large companies buy each other too, right? Mm-hmm. And so I've got a friend locally who is part of two enormous companies that just merged together, right? And those always create huge questions about what's going to happen now. So there is still lots of uncertainty that happens in large companies, but it's not day-to-day uncertainty, except maybe just with the politics part, right? And that just shouldn't be set aside gently because that could be pretty intense and traumatic. Yeah. But it's different kinds of problems that you're dealing with. And it is – running your own company, running an indie studio is not a thing that you can do for fun, right? Because like it's not
– It's your job.
It's your job. And I think it's recognizing the fact that the only time you should sell out is if you're willing to literally lose your company, right? That is the only condition on which you should sell your company. Because it's recognized coming to the other side that the other entity who wants to buy you, they're looking to make money somehow. Like that is why they're doing that. And so almost no indie companies out there are ones that somebody else would even try to buy, right?
Yeah, they don't make
enough money. They don't make enough money. And ours, somebody might try to invest in, but they wouldn't want to buy. And the reason they wouldn't want to buy it is because the moment they buy it, our relationship to the company changes a lot. And this is too small of a company where if the three of us were not running it anymore, the company would go away, right? That would be that. Mm-hmm. And so there's not a high incentive for somebody to buy the company unless they wanted the intellectual property. But our IP isn't valuable enough for somebody to give us like a fuckload of money.
We're in that kind of no man's land of –
People know we can do the work, so they'll want to pay us to do the work for them, or they'll want to buy stake in the company because they think that maybe we'll turn this thing into something big in the future, right? But yeah, so I think it's one of those things too that you have to realistically ask the question of just what does it mean for somebody, for an indie team, for an indie studio to start partnering? Because I would think of this as a partnership question. Like what are the partnership opportunities available? What do they mean? And if the partnership is a buyout, then that is the one where you have to be ready to lose your company and walk away. And so for me, the time when we'd be willing to do that is basically we have no other options. And then for some reason, somebody still wants the company, which would be a weird scenario to be in, right?
Or like you said, that we're just IP is – or that the IP is strong enough, but we don't have the ability to move it ahead anymore.
Right. Yeah. Yep.
And somebody else with more resources, like if we wanted it to be, Crashlands the movie or, what Levelhead the – I don't know.
But even that, if we were big enough for that to matter, we would just license that stuff out, right? We wouldn't actually sell the whole company in order to get that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. But if you want more resources, so if you're – because we've seen companies get bought up by like Microsoft and by Valve, for example, right? Because they just wanted access to more resources, which is frankly a perfectly valid reason to do that. Again, under the awareness that you might lose everything as a consequence, right? So if you're a small team, you're really good, there's some huge thing you want to make and you don't have the runway for it. And there's no publisher in a million years who would give you that runway and so on and so forth, right? But there's some company out there who like thinks that that's going to pay off and they want to invest in you and are willing to do it by buying your company. That could be a good move.
I think a good book, if you're a person who wants to go off and do your own thing somehow, and you're interested in these questions about like, what's a buyout for? Or like, how does the business side of these things work? Or what does it even mean to run your own business? Because like Sam was saying, there's a lot of fantasy to it, a lot of romanticizing about like, oh, I get to be my own boss and all these things. There's this great book called The E Myth. That's the letter E.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that one.
That's the letter E and then a dash. And then myth, M-Y-T-H.
I think it's E for entrepreneur, maybe.
Yes. Yeah. And the core premise of this book is it talks about the realities of what it looks like to go in and start your own business. And they use a great example that they kind of loop back to periodically with the idea of this person who loved making pies. And she was very so good at making pies. And all of her friends were like, dude. Your pies are so fucking good. I would buy these pies. I would pay you for these pies. And she hears this so much, and she doesn't like her day job. And she's like, maybe I could sell these pies. Starts up a pie shop. Pretty soon, in short order, she finds that Only like 5% of her time is going into making pies because she's running a business all day. She's like, she's got to get in super early, start baking. She's got to clean the place. She's got to clean the bathrooms. She's got to do taxes now. She's also an accountant. She's got to talk to lawyers. Mm-hmm. She's got to work with city regulators to make sure her building is up to code, you know? And eventually she's hiring, you know, 5 or 6 people to work at her company. And they're the ones making the pies, but they're not any good because she's the one who's good at making the pies. And now she just has a bad pie shop, right? Which wasn't her dream.
A very stressful bad pie shop.
Right? Yeah. Is your dream to be the manager of a bad pie shop? no, right?
Which, of course, doesn't mean that that's the only way that that could end up, right?
But, well, no. The whole point of the book is to talk about how to – keep that from being the place that you end up.
And that's by recognizing the reality that running a business is not the whole concept of like selling out is one that I just hate on every level. Like
it is only the things that fans who pay small amounts of money toward someone say to that person later on in their life, right?
Yeah.
Right. Well, I paid you $15. How come that is not enough?
Right. Or even if it's significantly more than that, right? It's the whole idea of Just the concept of selling out, right? Where you basically say like, yeah, you've built up this thing, you've built up this intellectual property, you've built up this company that has, you know, really good practices and training, et cetera, so that it could be grown or whatever. That you've built this thing, right? And that you don't deserve to make the decisions that you think are best for that thing, right?
Or even for yourself.
That decisions that you're making should be the ones that I want you to make, despite me not actually having any knowledge about what it means to run that thing. And like how I think about this with bands, right?
Yeah.
In particular, where this is the question all the time. Do you know how fucking hard it is to survive as a band? Like it is, if you think it's hard to survive as an indie game studio, if you're a band, you can't even make stuff for free. You know, like you can't, if you already have a laptop, you can be an indie game studio now. Right. But if you want to be a band, you have to go tour, you have to play at places, right? And it costs money to get there, and you're going to be getting paid less than it's cost you to do it for basically the whole fucking time. And if you're really lucky and meet the right people and start moving up the right chain, then maybe you get to go on a bigger tour, which is a fuckload of, can you imagine how much work that would be? Like just
you're just gone for 9 months, right?
Which like, yeah, and again, if, and if you, you have get to love sick doing some the night, thing yeah you gotta love doing the thing, but it's even if you, no matter how much you love it, that is a hard fucking thing to do. And if someone came to you after all of this, like you're building all this stuff up, and they said, okay, we're going to bring you on to our company. We're going to start managing this stuff for you. And to do that, though, you're going to have to follow, like, here's the things that we're going to start requiring for you to make that happen. Because, of course, it's got to be – everyone's got to win out somehow, right? And – but then to have me on the other side being like, well, I loved that – I loved that band when they were just – when they were poor as dirt and working out of their garage and could barely make ends meet and didn't know what their future looked like and didn't have health insurance, right? Like, I want them to stay in that state.
I liked it when they're suffering through
their music was better when it was born out of pain.
Which of course, in a lot of ways, is probably true, right? Yeah. But that doesn't give any of us as the consumers of that product the right to demand that a person continue to go through that pain and not get to get rewarded for their efforts and successes and the luck that they've
had. Well, you know, I think – there is an aspect of the selling out, which to me is basically – it's the idea of betraying your principles for a certain price, right? Mm-hmm. Which I don't think people use the term properly, right?
Yeah.
Like if it is the case that a band as the years go by, maybe like their music starts to sound a little bit more like other bands' music or something like that. Then there's this idea that, well, they're changing their sound, you know, to try to broaden their appeal or whatever. It's like, that's not like a core fundamental moral principle.
Yeah.
That's them just doing marketing.
Yeah. Well, but also, right? You're coming from the side now where you're saying like, I want them to make less money so that to be less successful so that fewer people can enjoy the stuff that they make, but where I'm one of those people, right? Which again, right. it's just an absurd stance to take.
Yeah, come on. I'm with you on that one, Adam.
I mean, I think the general point is like, as an indie, I guess this is the really important note. As an indie, if someone shows up and they're like, "We're going to give you a lot of money to either continue doing what you're doing, literally right now, or to just come work at our company," I think given the reality of the both the entrepreneurial experience, the indie experience, etc.,
it would be absurd to just walk away without
entertaining. Literally insane to not even entertain the conversation because like when you look at the like what's the point of a startup? Everyone talks about exit strategy at the beginning, right?
They're also,
like,
do you know how many indie studios make exactly one game? Basically every single one, right?
Yeah, because it's so fucking hard.
It's so fucking hard, and then it doesn't pay off, right? And then that's it. That's the end of the dream.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I think it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. You know,
totally reasonable.
Yeah. I would just worry about it more from a business angle, which is just if you were privileged enough to be in the situation where somebody is offering you money for your company or your game or whatever, then first of all, that's fucking great, and you should be pumped about that. And second of all, the goal of that other entity is almost always to get the far better end of that deal, right? So you just have to walk in with open eyes and be very careful. And the moment you give up any rights to the thing that you've created, you have to understand the fullest extent to which that could come back, which could mean the complete destruction of your studio or even your IP, right? And as long as you understand the fullest extent of the bad stuff that can happen, then if you think that's fine, because it's worth the trade-off. Because this is all risk stuff, right? Every single decision that we make is a risk-reward trade-off. Whether we're going to make, you know, Crash Lens 2 versus some other game, whether we're going to spend 2 years on it or three, whether we're going to put it into Xbox Game Pass or not, you know, like every single one of those decisions is a risk-reward decision. And there isn't just an answer where we just win and everybody else doesn't, or somehow everybody wins simultaneously and like everything is great and, you know, and like, and there's no downside for anybody anywhere. That's just not how any of this works. It's always looking at upsides and downsides and just trying to navigate it.
This is why you get tired after doing it for a while.
It's exhausting.
I would love someone tell me what to do. And I
want this to be someone else's problem.
We're still having discussions about whether we should be doing Crashlands 2 or not. Right.
Yeah.
Cause like we announced that we are and we really want to. And we still think we're going to, but still once a week, we're like, oh, fuck, is this a good idea? You know, because it is.
Well, we also know it's going to take years.
Yeah. You know? And if we fuck that up, if that was the wrong decision, right, then that may be the end of the company. And so it's easy to think about this in terms of like, oh, you shouldn't have sold yourself to this other company because now that's the end. But often just making the next game actually was the thing that destroyed your company or the next product in the more general sense, right?
You know? Yep.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and since we're not a giant multinational conglomerate, you know, if Tide makes their next you know, bubblegum flavored cleaning lollipop, that is it's a fraction of a percent of their total company.
We're not large enough to be able to absorb the risk associated with
this. So we fuck up one thing at our scale. And that's it.
Well, at our large scale, also when it comes to people, because we have to make sure that we're taking care of ourselves and our own families as well as our employees and their families, right? But if you're a huge company and an entire division fails because a product launch was not successful or whatever, and there's like maybe a couple hundred people there, there's a pretty good chance that all those people get to stay in the company.
They just get moved to
another division. They don't lose any institutional knowledge. Nobody loses employment. And actually everything comes out still fine, right? And actually all of the losses are just on the bottom line for the company as an entity, right? Yep. And nobody's really hurt, right? But when you're at the small company level, that is not how failure works at all.
High risk.
Everything is high risk.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. We would like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Koster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, just go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to everything you could ever want out of life.
Yep.
Thank you all for listening. See you next week.
Goodbye.